Welcome to the UKIS ITEL podcast. I'm Sarah Hall, Deputy Director at UKANA Changing Europe. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Louisa Moore, who's a Professor of Political Geography at Durham University. She's particularly interested in how forms of data and algorithmic analysis, and we'll explain what that is in a minute, are changing ideas around state security and what it means to live in society today. Her most recent book is called Cloud Ethics and was published by Duke University Press. And Louise is currently halfway through a major five-year project funded by the European Research Council, which examines these themes. Welcome, Louise. So let's start really simply. Can you explain to me what machine learning technologies are? So these are totally central to your research, and what risks they might pose.
Yes, certainly. It seems like a very simple question, doesn't it? But actually, of course, the discussion around machine learning as a concept goes back as far as the 1950s. And actually, we can find computer scientists in the 1950s, Arthur Samuel, for example, describing machine learning as giving computers the ability to learn without explicitly being programmed. And I think there's something about those debates in the 1950s, even Alan Turing was involved in this question of whether it was possible for a machine to learn something in excess of the direct programming that had been controlled by a human. And so though we often think of this as a kind of new issue that we're talking about in contemporary society, in fact, this goes back nearly 100 years, this kind of central question around whether it's possible for a machine learning technology to discover something in data beyond the things that have explicitly been programmed. So when we think about machine learning now, we're most commonly talking about things called neural networks. And the neural network is really a particular kind of algorithm that's trained on data. And we see it across so many spheres of our life today, from the recognition of images or text through to things like bank transactions or human faces. So with the neural network, major breakthroughs took place in the early 21st century. And here this was the so-called AlexNet algorithm that was able to recognize images much more accurately than any previous algorithm had ever been able to do. And it was trained on a labeled data set. But the important thing about this algorithm, and the reason why it caused such a huge shift in the way that we think about the possibilities for technologies today, is that it was adaptive in terms of its capacity to learn. So the neural network can adapt its weights inside the neural network. And we can think of this as just giving some greater weight to some pieces of that data than to others. And it's able to adapt that in terms of the output that it's getting. So the model is trained around a target output. That could be something as simple as correctly recognizing a cat and being able to differentiate that from a dog. Now, this is important because so many of the risks that are said to flow from machine learning technologies come precisely from this ambition, you know, the ambition to be able to learn something beyond that was programmed. So we can see how this could generate anxiety in terms of the kind of ethical frameworks or the way that society regulates those algorithms. What do we do about automated decision making in our world, particularly where those decisions might be really important for someone's life chances? You know, is it okay for an algorithm to do something beyond that explicit programming that might have an output that's so significant for somebody's life chances? So we tend to see the risks and concerns that flow from machine learning as centering on this question of whether one can control or whether one can influence the output of the algorithm. But in the work that I've been doing these past few years, I want us to try to think about machine learning as not only about potentially harmful outputs in the world, but also as being quite radically different ways of organising our society. So how we classify populations or how we differentiate among different people. And here we begin to see, I guess, a form of ordering that many people have correctly identified can intensify already existing racialized or gendered inequalities, for example. So how we think about machine learning very much shapes that sense of what should the place of machine learning then be in our society.
And can you talk us through like a specific example? I know you've done some work in the world of finance that I work on, but is there like a concrete example you could talk the listeners through just so we can kind of get a handle on that?
So, I mean, an example that perhaps we're seeing in the news at the moment would be facial recognition technologies. So facial recognition technologies use machine learning. In many ways, they use quite conventional forms of deep neural network to recognise faces. And the listeners may have seen that there's been some debate currently in the UK around whether the data on facial recognition algorithms should be shared between, for example, shopping centres, police forces, and so on. And in fact, whether the data set of passport images that we submit for our passport in the UK, whether it is or is not ethical for those images to be part of that training data set and to be part of the image recognition database. So I think concrete examples are all around us. And the debates very much, again, centre on this question of whether we can have adequate oversight or accountability for those sorts of technologies.
And your answer there brings me to my next question. Obviously, the podcast is part of UK and a Changing Europe. So I'm really interested in how machine learning technologies sit with the wider European project. And I think in your answer, you've started to tease out questions of, you know, the role of the state, the relationship between the state and society. So I was just wondering if there were sort of particular instances of that that you'd like to sort of highlight when we think about Europe and the relationship between the UK and Europe.
Yes, thank you, Sarah. It's such a good question. And actually, in the work that I've been doing recently around the politics of machine learning, I would trace a really direct link between the European project of the integration of European states and this longer history of the project of machine learning. So where in the 1950s, in the context of a post-war society, in the context of all of the uncertainties and insecurities of the Cold War, I think we really do have a parallel there between the sort of neo-functionalist project of the EU, in which designing a system that brought together crucial functions, like in the European Coal and Steel Community, for example, that actually that's mirrored. And the historian of science, Lorraine Daston, points to this in her brilliant work on the history of algorithms. In the 1950s, this is mirrored by an approach to the use of machine learning technologies as potential ways to try to tame some of those dangers and excesses of a world on the brink in the 1950s. That's the language that Daston uses, the idea of algorithms with a world on the brink. So to me, the European project and the project of the development of algorithmic technologies are actually quite tightly tied together. And I think it's just such an important topic that you're bringing to your listeners for us to think about that. And if we bring it into the 21st century and start to think about the sorts of risks that are confronted now in the deployment of those technologies. So one example could be much earlier in 2023, I think it was February or March time, it was reported that the Dutch city of Rotterdam, for example, had produced risk scores for 30,000 welfare claimants in and around the city of Rotterdam. And this risk scoring had been done using a machine learning algorithm that was trained on around 12,000 previous fraud investigations into welfare. So what was happening was that particular individuals who were, you know, vulnerable and quite dependent on particular sorts of state intervention and welfare were being profiled on the basis of what the algorithm had learned from the data it was exposed to. So I'm suggesting that Europe is now confronting new challenges where in some cases these sorts of machine learning tools are beginning to pick up some of the functions that the European states have developed over the past 60, 70 years or so, and that the questions about fairness and the questions about inequality are rising again, and that we need new ways of thinking about the sorts of issues that can happen. So in the case of Rotterdam, for example, it was clear in the analysis that was done by Lighthouse Report and Wired magazine that if you were a young person who was a parent, a woman, you were a non-Dutch speaker, you were unemployed and looking for work, those things were likely to contribute to a high risk score for welfare fraud, and therefore a freezing of your welfare payments. So it's just one example of many, but I think it does highlight that question of the connections between a set of algorithmic technologies and a broader political project that has changed in Europe from the mid-20th century to the early 21st century. Yeah.
That's really interesting, and it touches on one of the sort of wider themes in your work around the risks posed to society by these technologies. The book where you kind of set this out most fully was published in 2020, so about 3 years ago. And I was just wondering what progress had been made in your view in addressing some of the risks that you've just set out, risks for particular people in Rotterdam, like you've just discussed. So, for example, the EU is at the moment set to ban the use of methods like predictive policing and sort of emotion recognition as part of its draft AI Act. So I wondered if you could just talk to us about what's happened in the past 3 years and what issues have emerged more recently.
Yes, thank you, Sarah. It's a good question. And actually, it's a longer period than 3 years, really. I guess that book was submitted in 2018. So there's a 5 year period in a way to consider in terms of how that picture has changed. But more specifically, what you're asking here, I think, is about whether progress has been made in terms of a response to these kinds of technologies. And I think that necessary steps have been taken. But in the main, they have followed what in the book I describe as an encoded approach to AI ethics. That is the desire to try to encode a clear set of rules or regulations that apply to the use of algorithms. And I should be clear that I think that that work is absolutely necessary and it's crucial, but it's also insufficient. So on its own, it's insufficient for so many reasons. One is that it's when we think about the AI ethics as being an encoded system of rules to follow, then as the actual technologies of artificial intelligence change so rapidly, they rapidly undercut the progress that's been made in terms of accountability and regulation. So because my approach to the algorithm is that we should understand it as it adapts in relation to its environment and to what it's exposed to, I think that the existing progress that's been made needs to actually shift its focus. And I'll give you a real example to try and make that clearer for the listeners. So I think a really important step was made a couple of years ago in the UK context, where a group of legal advocates at Foxglove Law challenged the visa allocation algorithm that was being used by the Home Office. And they challenged that on the grounds of the protected characteristics of race. So in effect, they were saying, if you have nationality as an input to your machine learning algorithm, then that actually is a proxy for race and therefore is already unlawful in terms of the use of that algorithm. And they won that case. And the Home Office undertook to remove the data input of nationality from their visa and immigration algorithms. But what's happened in that five-year period, what's really happened in that five-year period is that machine learning algorithms, particularly as they become more close to kind of generative AI systems, are able to remove particular inputs, but still potentially generate outputs that are deeply racialized. So in the case of the immigration algorithm, one could remove nationality as a data input, a necessary step, and yet still other patterns and correlations in data. It could be past patterns of travel. It could be migrants sending remittances home to particular regions of the world. It could be particular banking or financial transactions. Also, through their connections and relationships in the data, serve this role of proxy. So just to try to sort of illustrate my point, that it was necessary, of course, and quite a major win to have nationality removed as a data input, but still insufficient to be able to fully deal with the way the algorithm is able to adapt in terms of other forms of data that it's exposed to in its environment.
Hello, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to remind you to sign up to the UK in a Changing Europe newsletter, which comes out every week, featuring our latest research and news about our exciting range of events. Subscribe now on our website.
So one of the major themes of work at UK in a Changing Europe is about the question of regulation and how regulation is changing in relation to a whole range of issues, you know, including the environment, industry, etc. But I think one of the spheres where regulation is really active and lively is in relation to AI, particularly given the fact that regulation on the one hand is usually about control, and your work emphasises the ways in which algorithms try to escape control. So I'm interested in what are the sort of big regulatory questions here? And then it would be a bit remiss of me from UK in a Changing Europe not to ask if there is a difference in approach between the UK and the EU.
I think there are links to your work here as well, actually, in terms of the City of London, because, you know, when we think about what took place in the 1980s, deregulation, the Big Bang, you know, what was the particular approach that the UK took in terms of the deregulation of financial services? And that is my reading of the direction of travel for the UK in relation to AI. And of course, you know, in many cases, I guess we have to say all forms of regulation in markets are also about expanding and extending those markets. So I think it's, you know, it's not only a question of deregulation. But I think the ambition for AI in the UK is to have a kind of second Big Bang, where the thing that is assetized, as brilliant research actually by Devika Narayan in Bristol around the assetization of data and models, that's taking place with the kind of expansion of the kind of AI project and the vision of the idea that somehow, you know, data is the new oil, or, you know, that notion of the idea of it as an asset. She's doing absolutely brilliant work on that. So to me, this kind of process of assetization is taking place. And the generative AI vision is, I think, one where that becomes the infrastructure for this to take place, right? So it becomes a kind of cloud-based and platformed infrastructure for a particular kind of market. So thinking about the EU AI Act, and especially actually the European Parliament's input and responses to the proposals in the AI Act, I think that there is a recognition there that I currently see somewhat absent in the UK discussion, which is that there's a recognition that the benefits of this process do not automatically necessarily flow to society. And so, you know, again, a kind of necessary set of steps to be taken to try to govern and control some of the potential harmful effects of the expansion of these technologies. Frankly, in the UK, I think that there's evidence of the reverse happening. So the Information Commissioner's Office, we might say that the regulator's office would require greater resources to be able to deal with this fast expansion. And actually what we're seeing is a reduction in resources, a collapsing of other crucial oversight offices that were formalised in the UK, the Biometrics Commissioner, crucial. You know, biometric data will absolutely be, integral to the formation of much of this technology, and the EU has found ways to address that. The surveillance camera commissioner's functions being collapsed. So I see actually a stripping out in the UK over the past decade of many of the existing functions, and not a kind of not sufficiently taking seriously actually the need to have oversight and accountability for the way that these tools are developed. And, you know, as we see in the kind of EU response, I think more closely, the question of who benefits from, for example, making available all patient records data to a US military company like Palantir? You know, are we having a public debate about that, or are we just waiting for the outcome of a procurement process? So I have concerns, and I am yet to be convinced that the enthusiasm and the embracing of this kind of rush to a generalized AI model that can be, you know, adapted for every new task that's posed by industry or by government, that that's being met fully by a adequate resourcing of mechanisms of accountability and oversight, actually.
You've raised some like really fundamental issues that as a society we might need to think more carefully about in terms of the place of, you know, algorithmic decision making. So the ethical dimension, the political scrutiny question, the public debate question. What steps do you think might be taken to address some of these really fundamental issues about the place of these models in our society?
Yeah, it's the classic what do we do question, isn't it? And I, you know, part of me resists the what steps formulation in the sense that I want to resist the idea that we can fix it. I think a really good starting point would be an acceptance, in a sense, that they can never be fully fixed, but that in some ways that's not a new problem, you know? So we look back to the 19th century, we know that the use of the kind of Gaussian bell curve, which became fundamental to how populations were governed, according to averages, according to the average man, you know, l'homme typique. So we know that those models had consequences, many of them colonial consequences, racialized consequences in our world. And that it couldn't be fixed in that sense. What mattered was to be able to recognize and acknowledge fully the politics of that model that's at work. So I think what I'm going to say is about setting out steps, but it's also about saying that these steps are never going to be enough on their own, right? So I guess it's a caveat, but it's a caveat that I think is an important one. So a first step that would be helpful would be to review the, I guess, the existing protections that we have in society that we consider to be fundamental to our rights and freedoms. And we need to think very carefully about how those very hard-won protections are undercut by a different way of understanding population that comes about through these sorts of machine learning and generative AI tools. So an example of that could be protected characteristics at every layer of public life, and actually even in terms of private and commercial domains as well. This notion that there are protected characteristics, that we would include race and gender and sexuality, for example, in those characteristics. That my point about attribution and inference in these models is that the protected characteristics of those sorts of protections are being changed and undercut by the tools. So a good example of that would be some great work that's being done by Tao Fan and Scott Walk on what they call racial formations and data formations. And they're making, in a sense, a really simple point about very complicated models. They're saying this form of clustering is generating a new approach to race that is not ever directly identifiable, that we need to think in a much more expansive way about how these models are generating racialized categories. So reviewing existing protections and asking ourselves whether protected characteristics can include the sorts of attribution of characteristics that these algorithms are involved in. And then I think that a second point actually does relate to GDPR, but a very specific aspect of GDPR provisions, which is about the notion of the decision that's made about us. But I guess that, to me, that's always been a crucial part of this, like how to be protected from not only automated or automatic or machine decisions made about us, but increasingly decisions that are going to be crucial for our lives, which have been made in a sort of collaboration between human and machine. That really troubles me, because I think that if we were to query was that decision about my welfare or my housing allocation or my credit line, was that a fully automated decision? The answer could be no. But actually, if the human being making the decision is prompting a generative AI model, then I would say that that is, you know, that should count. So I would want, again, for us to revisit some of these questions about decisions made about us that have crucial impacts on our life chances, and think about how new forms of artificial intelligence are extending the scope for the machine's output to insert itself into the decision that's made about us. And I guess a final step, I'm not sure whether this might be a step too far, but it's about a different approach to ethics, and it's about trying to embed a different approach to AI ethics at every layer of public life, or at every step that we would seek to have public accountability in the kind of the world that we're dealing with. That could be in schools, it could be in policing, it could be in health. So where we assume that accountability should mean that there is a kind of clear a possibility to follow a clear set of steps or a clear chain in a decision, I think giving accounts or accountability in AI decisions is going to be extremely difficult to do and very difficult to challenge. And already in some of the interviews we've been doing, for example, with lawyers working with generative AI, you know, this question of like what to do with generated evidence or how to think differently, even about what counts as evidence in the courtroom, these things are always going to fall short. So this different approach to ethics that I would like to see embedded would be one where we say, how has this very contingent, very fragile output of the algorithm come to be definitive in whatever the sphere of life it is? How has it come to be seen to be definitive? And how might we challenge it and unsettle it and show that actually there were alternate pathways that could have been followed? And this, you know, to me, this is actually also about the very many moments historically where people have been able to gather together to make a claim, you know, whether it's civil rights histories or whether it's about equality and gender and sex rights and so on. You know, this has required people to challenge a particular narrative and where those narratives are being amplified by AI technologies. The challenge is going to be more difficult. So we need this different approach to ethics, and it needs to be an approach to ethics that is able to doubt, question and challenge the output of the algorithm at every step. Yeah.
I guess one of the kind of ways in which listeners might be thinking about this is kind of the role of private sector firms and big tech companies in particular within this sphere. And it's been in the news quite a bit recently in terms of takeovers and access to data. Do you think we're asking enough of large technology companies in terms of their leadership and ethical leadership in this space?
I suppose that the approach that I've always taken is that the tech companies, of course, that's important in terms of the kind of political economies that are going on here and the kind of power dynamics that are going on here. So, you know, to go back to the example of Palantir and NHS data, for example, and this notion of access to NHS data to build new models and to find new kinds of solutions. But those models themselves are also built on computer science. So I would want to insert into this discussion the relationship between government firms and science. You know, this has been part of the project, the Algorithmic Societies project that I'm working on at the moment, has been to try to map the breakthroughs in computer science that happen on the pages of some of the more arcane machine learning journals that then two years later become part of how DeepMind or OpenAI just do business. You know, so, and that is a really crucial set of links, and that accountability needs to be there too, right? So we're often talking about public universities and public funding, you know, Cambridge, Toronto, UCLA, Oxford, and the relationship between the tech companies and the science is where I would start. So, you know, most of the kind of major breakthroughs that have led to generative AI have come about through the work that's been done by people like Ilya Sutskever at OpenAI, but working together with, you know, his PhD students who then go on to publish their work. So I think that we need to understand this set of relationships as being a really important new power dynamic in a way, or maybe not even that new a power dynamic, but to be able to hold it, them to account. So I suppose in short, in answer to your question, we're not asking enough of the tech companies. But I also have a concern that regulating and controlling the tech companies could be seen as enough when actually the knowledge power that is coming from the pages of the computer science journals, which we've recently written an essay about in Big Data and Society, which is, you know, trying to pick apart where did those big breakthroughs happen? How does a paper get cited 200,000 times? You know, and the authors have bracketed after their names, Google, DeepMind, OpenAI. So what are the links between the kind of ways of doing that become embedded in the technology and then the commercial exploitation of that technology? So, sorry, that was a kind of long answer to your question, but yes, we need to demand more, but it shouldn't stop at the boundary of the commercial enterprise. It needs to also address the science question.
So I always love stories in academia where people are tracing where ideas come from and where they go. So that paper I'm definitely going to read after this interview. But it brings me to my final question, which is about, and really relates in many ways to the sort of core function of UK in a changing Europe, about, you know, we're concerned with making social science accessible. And I guess your work makes us think about, you know, how do we make science accessible both to the public, but also crucially to politicians and policymakers who are tasked with managing the risks of AI. Do you think those audiences understand it sufficiently, or put another way, how might we make our society and our politics more AI literate?
I often think that when I see this, well, the current denuding of funding to the humanities, for example, it's incredible to me. Huge expansion in the flow of funding to machine learning teams, computer science departments and universities, and a stripping out of the humanities. And yet, at the core of what we're talking about here are crucial questions of the humanities, literacy, reading. The human. What does it mean to be human? How does that change with these kinds of tools? So, in a way, I guess part of my project is to try to reverse the logic that we should make people understand the technical of these technologies, and instead say, well, actually, those who are building the models are working with concepts that are widespread in the humanities and understood by societies. Quite, you know, really simple concepts like a group, what is a group, or generalization. So hugely sought after at the moment by most people building generative AI models, something that can be generalized and used for new problems. Now, these are questions that, you know, are really long-standing questions for the humanities, and I think are widely understood in terms of people's, you know, sense of their world. And so I think that the slippage that happens in the vocabulary, where, for example, predictive tools, I think earlier you mentioned predictive tools, we can talk about prediction, we can talk about the power of prediction and the problems, the ethical challenges of prediction. Do we necessarily need to explain fully how a particular machine learning model arrives at its predictive capacity? And I suppose a parallel could be, we understand what it means to say an average, or to talk about a population having a mean or having tails in the bell curve. We kind of have a sense of what that means and what the implications of it might be, without necessarily understanding the kind of Gaussian mathematics and statistical approaches that underlie it. So of course it's crucial for us as scholars, I think, to engage with the technical in detail, and that's what my five-year project is about, you know, taking these models, trying to pick them apart and explain their politics in ways that can be understood to a more general audience. That's really part of what we want to try and do. And I guess also to kind of think about how people can be empowered to challenge and to respond. If somebody's child's A-level results or GCSE results were going to be predicted by algorithm, which was the spectre that loomed in 2020, I found that a really interesting moment. I wrote an article for The Guardian that week when it happened, because suddenly everyone was talking about algorithms because it was affecting their lives. And, you know, school children were marching with banners saying, you know, stop the algorithm, don't decide my future by algorithm. And that was a moment where the technical broke the surface of a public debate. We need more moments like that, right, where we can actually open up the implications and say, is this fair, and push back and resist in the parts of our world where we think that there should be no place for these sorts of technologies.
Thanks, Louise, and thank you for giving up the time to discuss your work and your current project. It's been absolutely fascinating, raising really fundamental questions of what it means to be human in an algorithmic world. Thank you.